Okay, it is the 12th of February, and whose idea? Was that yours, Ricardo's? First Solar? Whose idea was to pick up First Solar? This is why, you know, mutual fund investors sometimes get ribbed. Because if you buy individual stocks, when this happens, you know, 18% in 3 weeks, you get, wow, that feels really good.
And then when it's 18% down, it doesn't feel so good.
So you're protected from that when you buy mutual funds. But when you buy, but you don't get that excitement when, oh, the Apple's up almost 13, it's over 12.
Don't look at Procter & Gamble, okay?
But 3.5%, folks, that's not typical. Don't expect that kind of return. Over, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, it doesn't often happen. But sometimes it does. It does, you get excited. Questions, thoughts, ideas? So what's due? The assignments are due today. I have a stapler, so please staple them together. But just, if you don't, just make sure your name's on both of them. Next Thursday, I'm feeling better, folks. I'm still not 100%, but I am feeling better. I'm off the drugs. But I everything, coughing and sneezing. It's painful. It sounds like it feels like somebody's stabbing you and hitting you with a baseball bat at the same time. Wow. Don't bruise your ribs. But chapters 1 and 4, so introduction to investments, risk versus return, overview of investments, short-term investments, and then everything about mutual funds. No calculations, future value, no, that's not there. So don't need a calculator. But you can bring one page of handwritten notes in a scan and bring a Scantron. And there will be some essay to do, and we'll take a look at that on Thursday in more detail. Okay, so let's continue where we left off. But first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? Yes.
Did I tell you about the famous Italian chef who passed away?
Yeah, very sad. He passed away.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, did I tell you about the neutron who walks into a bar?
Neutron walks into a bar? Yeah, tell me. I know this one. But tell us that theory. Neutron walks into a bar. It's one of my favorites. No charge, because he's a neutron, so he doesn't have a charge. I like that one. See, that's what I'm, but see, I like bad jokes. All right, so as you remember, if you weren't here, then you need to, you know, go back and look it over. We went through the stock mutual funds, starting with the most aggressive to the least aggressive stock mutual funds, and we'll see what that means later on. They're still, you know, still stocks, so they still go up and down. But aggressive growth funds, and then capital appreciation funds wrapping themselves around the aggressive growth in the growth world. And then growth in income. And what I forgot to mention is that people will also refer to growth in income as blend funds. They'll also refer to them sometimes as value funds. But be careful because, as we're going to see, growth and value have different meanings depending on who you are and how you use them in the industry. We'll deal with that in the next chapter. Now, equity income funds are the least riskiest of stock funds because they invest in the most conservative, stodgy companies like food companies and railroads and utilities and real estate investment trusts. And then we overlaid both the size of the companies, large, mid-cap, small-cap, and the domesticity, where it's based, domestic, global, international. And we came up with, you know, one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. And that's why we have this explosion of mutual funds out there. So that's where we ended up, right? Okay, we're going to continue with that. And by the end of today, we will have, well, hopefully before that, we will have the board covered up with the different types of mutual funds. And then I could have put this on its own slide, because the mutual fund companies have further concentrated into regions of the world, the Far East, Latin America, Japan, Canada, the Nordic countries, Northern European, and different emerging markets. They used to be called third world. Shh, don't do that anymore. In fact, it was the 1980s when the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, through the World Bank, created one of the first emerging markets funds, and they wanted to call it the Third World Fund. The bankers, who want nothing to do with it in New York, said, you know, you go right ahead, you want to lose money, it's up to you. But for God's sake, at least don't call it the Third World Fund, right? Don't, you know, don't refer to it as the Third World Countries. And so the term emerging markets came out. And it turned out that it was a very volatile fund, and they lost a lot of money, which is another way for volatile. But since then, they've done really, really well. Since the 1980s, the developing markets, the emerging markets, have exploded and imploded and exploded and imploded. More volatility. Now, the sector funds and the market timing funds are even for more concentration. My personal opinion, and you can, you know, it's up to you. You don't have to believe or agree with whatever I say, is that this is the wrong thing to do in a mutual fund. Sure, if you knew, if you've been down into Latin America and you see it's blossoming, or you're in energy or wireless or whatever whatever sector of the economy that you know something about, and you see that it's ready to explode or implode, sure, load up a little bit of your plate. Remember the buffet we were using, the idea of the buffet? Put a little bit of these sector funds that just invest in wireless or just invest in medicine or whatever into your 401k or your regular account. Because the idea, why do we have mutual funds to begin with? What are the two major reasons we have mutual funds? If somebody asks you, well, why do you have a mutual fund? Diversification was one of them. And the other one was professional money management. So that if we are now taking mutual funds and concentrating, does that make sense to you? Yeah? To me, no. And that's why there's chocolate and vanilla and some people like strawberry. But I'm more interested in broad. I want global. I want to see, you know, broad-based mutual funds. The wider the net, the better, in my humble opinion. But, of course, that's going to lower the volatility and lower the potential for large gains, but also the potential for large losses. Make sense? Am I going too fast? Nod your head yes? Yeah. Got it? Okay, good. Excuse me. My intent is not to bore you. If I do, please tell me. Now, okay. Bonds. We're going to spend some time on bonds, but bonds, folks, are stodgy and boring and reliable. They're not going to make us rich, 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 but then again, they're not going to make us sad and cry in our beer. Another term are fixed income funds, because we know what kind of return we're going to get on our interest. And these are mutual funds that invest in various kinds and grades of bonds with income as the primary objective. Again, we're going to go from the most riskiest with regard to bonds to the least riskiest. And the most riskiest are called high yield bonds funds. But is that what we normally call them? What do people usually call them? Junk bond funds. High income, high yield. Sometimes they'll use the word distressed, or not, maybe not distressed, but they'll use the word like, you know, these things are a little bit in trouble. And it turns out that these can be fairly volatile junk bond funds and go down 30% or something like that. But they're a little strange, because junk bonds in general are more often correlated with stocks than they are with bonds. As we're going to see, bonds and stocks tend to do well countercyclical to one another. When stocks go up, bonds go down. When stocks go down, bonds go up. Not always. Sometimes they all go down at the same time or up at the same time. But junk bond funds tend to be more thrown over there in the stock world. But corporate bond funds are your straight arrow funds. These are funds which are going to have high credit quality companies, large companies, and bonds where companies, you know they're going to pay their debts. It's like the people with the high credit ratings are going to pay their mortgages and their credit cards and their car loans. And they usually have a typical rating of A or above, and we'll discuss these ratings of bonds in more detail. So they're staid and tried and true. And some of them are convertibles. Doesn't that sound exciting? Convertible bonds, kind of like convertible cars. You're one whipping through the down the freeway with the hair, your wind through your hair, smiling at everyone until you have to get the darn thing up and it's raining and it won't go up. It's the same thing with true convertible bonds. They don't always work out the way everyone thinks they're going to work out. And then the next group are muni bonds, municipal bonds that are offered by state and local governments where the income is free from federal taxes. So these are very popular with high net worth, high income individuals who are in high tax brackets. For the little folks, you and I, they're not that big a deal. And if we buy a municipal bond that is specific to our state, for our example, California, then not only do we not pay federal taxes, we don't pay state income taxes. So we live in California. If we buy a California municipal bond, doesn't matter where it is in the state, could be Chula Vista, could be Eureka, as long as it's in the state of California, we don't pay federal taxes, income taxes, and we don't pay state income taxes. Make sense? All right. Next group are the U.S.-backed and U.S. bonds. Now, for years, the U.S. government said, we are not backing these bonds. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae, Sally Mae, these were all entities that were sponsored by the Congress. And there was, for many years, a tacit and implicit, that means unspoken, guarantee that if these entities go down, the federal government would step in. But the Congress bozos, Congress represent your erected representatives, kept saying, no, 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 Fannie Mae is a private company, Fannie Mae, and they made a lot of money, folks, for investors and for themselves, until 2008. And then what happened? Yeah, we had the Great Recession. Why do they call it great? I don't know. But guess what? You and I are now co-owners of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Because when the organic matter hit the ventilating device and people stopped paying their mortgages, these things looked like they were going to go down. But the truth is, now this is not something we capitalists like to admit, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have recovered and are now making tens of billions of dollars for the federal treasury every year. Do you think that's something that you want to do, folks? Do you want to be a taxpayer and have your government in the business of making mortgages for people? No? Well, it's been profitable for us. we've made money. I'm talking about the U.S. Treasury. And now there's plenty of space. Come on in. Now the issue is how do we got this tiger by the tail. It's what's keeping the housing market alive. We're making money off of it, the federal treasury. How do we divest ourselves? How do we get rid of it? How do we unwind this? And, of course, any congressperson or senator or the president who proposes any kind of idea gets attacked because you're going to make somebody unhappy no matter how this happens. So if you're so inclined, follow this. We'll come back to it later when we get the bonds. So here they are. And then last are the U.S. Treasury. The U.S. Treasury. Do you worry about the Treasury going bankrupt? Do you worry about the United States Treasury? We're going to be $20 trillion in debt. This is true. We're going to have to pay it off, and it's not going to be easy. It's going to happen. We're going to have to pay it off. But don't worry. The United States government is not going bankrupt anytime soon. There are some people who think we're going to have problems because we just can't agree to deal with the issue. And it'll be the kind of thing where it was a few years ago where they had to do it at the point of a gun.
Yeah, the dumbest thing to me was when there was this drive back in the 80s, the 1980s, to pay off the national debt.
Right.
And people sent money. And it's the dumbest thing. I mean, don't they know the government's going to spend it, make the debt bigger?
Exactly, right. Just deal what you got to have now. What's on my plate now? Let's deal with what's on my plate now. No, it's true. You're absolutely right. We have to deal with it. We have to deal with it, and we will. But now we get into politics, and I just get really disturbed when I see the Republirats and the demagogues yelling and screaming and hollering at one another, because it seems to be that's the national debate now. If you watch Weasel News or Skunk News, Fox News, and then they, you know, talk about how horrible the demagogues are. Nobody's perfect. So, but I think we're going to do it. I'm optimistic. You think, you know, are you optimistic about the future? Yeah. I see a lot of blank stares. I am. And then, again, just as we did with stocks, we're going to overlay two more categories. Long-term, intermediate-term, and short-term. And then domestic, global, and international. Now, domestic and global international are similar. It used to be that domestic was where the risk was not. International was much more risky one, and global was in between. But, you know, that's changing now because the world is global. But this one's a little tricky. Which one of these do you think is the most risky? Which one's the least risky?
Short,
see, this is the tricky part. It's a curveball. You see large cap L, small cap S, long L, short S, and then intermediate and mid are about the same, right? It's exactly turned around. In terms of bonds, you're lending your money. Do you think it's riskier to lend your money out for 20, 30 years or 2-3 years? Yes. These are the riskiest, but also have the potential for better return. These are the least risky, because when you let your money out for 2 or 3 years, there's far less opportunity for things to go bad than when you leave your money out for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and intermediate 5, 7, 10 years is in between. Make sense? Okay, so you need to know that. You need to know that. Questions? And then what we do, as we did on the scramble sheet, is we find that the mutual fund companies go, oh, it's a domestic long-term corporate bond fund or whatever it is, junk bond fund. So we pick one from column A and one from column B and one from column C and make a mess of all the different mutual funds that are available. Okay, am I going too slow? You're kind of quiet here. Balance funds. Balance funds are the next on the... Wait a minute. Balance funds are a blend of stocks and bonds. So shouldn't we see that they belong in the... If we're going from the riskiest to the least riskiest, shouldn't they be in between stocks and bonds? When you add something that's very risky to something that's a lot less risky, you'd think you'd be in the middle. Well, it turns out that it's counterintuitive again. Balance funds, because stocks and bonds are negatively correlated, and what the hell does that mean? We'll discuss it later on. But it means when stocks go down, bonds often go up, and vice versa. So when you blend the two, you have a tendency, if you do it well, to smooth out the ups and downs of both. Because when one does well, the other one doesn't do so well, and vice versa. So it turns out the balance funds exhibit less volatility, which, as we know, is an imperfect measure of risk to begin with, than a stock fund or a bond fund in and of itself. Most well-run balance funds will keep a 50-50, 60-40 mix of stocks and bonds. But the allocation can change as the investment environment changes, depending on the investment managers, the people in the top heads, idea of what they're going to do. One of the nation's oldest balance fund is called the American Balance Fund, 1937. It states that the fund is managed as the complete U.S. investment program of a prudent investor. So in other words, this is one of those funds that you can buy and just forget about, especially if you're worried about the stock market crashing. They will never be more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds, and never be less than 50-50 stocks and bonds. So they will always stay balanced. Make sense? Yeah? Yeah, balance funds are boring, but for people who are really worried, especially if they're young, and worried about the stock market, they're a great choice. I think they're too conservative for most younger folks. I normally would not recommend them. I wouldn't want to buy one. But that's, you know, me, and that's why there's chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. Did I ever tell you the story of chocolate, vanilla, and people like strawberry? I have a friend from college. She passed away very sad. But she was gorgeous, and all the guys just loved her. And so did I. But she moved to London and met a guy in England, fell in love and got married, had two kids. And he was brilliant. He was a trader of commodities, oil trader. They came to the United States and traveled around in an RV and stopped in San Diego and came to see me. And he just said, you know, we know in Europe that the United States is large. We know that it's a vast country, but you just don't really understand how large it is until you drive it. It is amazing. And, of course, he had a beautiful British accent. He said, you drive through Alabama from one side of the state to the other, and it's all pine trees. And you don't understand. In the UK, every tree is cataloged. You can't do anything. You can't cut it down. You can't trim it unless you have all these certifications because it has a life and it's totally different. You think, of course, you Americans think that everything is bigger and will always be such. I walked into a Baskin Robbins or a Ben and Jerry's. There was 50 different flavors. What do you do with 50 different flavors? In the UK, there's chocolate and vanilla, and they're out of strawberry. And I said, okay, well, I'm American. I said, why don't you go back to the UK, open up a Ben and Jerry's or a Baskin Robbins or whatever, and have 50 different flavors. He goes, no, you don't understand. We don't want 50 different flavors. That's why they're out of strawberry. Nobody wants it. They just want chocolate and vanilla. Okay. Okay. So Americans, they want... We want 50 different flavors, right? How many do you try? One or two. Yes, you would buy. Yeah. I walked into I was in a Ben and Jerry's. Guy walked in. He goes up to get usual. The usual. I went to the guy. Said, chocolate chip cookie dough. He goes, yeah. Okay, that's the usual. So if you go into a Ben and Jerry's, you say the usual. You mean chocolate chip cookie dough. Okay, fine. Now, how did they get on that? Oh, chocolate and vanilla. And some people like strawberry. Asset allocation funds. Here, again, is where it gets a little tricky, because these funds are lumped in together with balance funds. Asset allocation funds, though, are very different, because the investment advisor will publicly state in the prospectus that they will diligently try to fine-tune the allocation as market conditions change. Whereas a balance fund, a well-run, in my humble opinion, balance fund, will stay about 40, 60, 50, 50, 70, 30. The asset allocation fund might move everything into stocks or everything into bonds or everything into cash. Now, to me, this smacks of what is called market timing. Market timing, as we will discuss later on and today and in the future, is something that you just don't even want to get involved with. There are people who believe that what they're doing is right, but no one's ever been able to time the market efficiently over the long term. So, in my humble opinion, would steer clear of anything that smacks of market timing, any kind of asset allocation funds. But you really have to dig deep underneath the surface and see if they're trying to do that or not. And then the last group, the least riskiest, are the money market mutual funds, which we've already discussed in Chapter 1 because they're one of the short-term investments that we have. They are they invest in short-term money market instruments, treasury bills, corporate paper, bankers' acceptance notes. They're much the same as the money market accounts at banks and credit unions, except that money market funds are not guaranteed, but we know that when the organic matter hits the ventilating device, some white knight, the Federal Reserve Bank or whoever, goes and runs in and says, don't worry about your money market accounts. There are general purpose, treasury bills, commercial papers. There are tax-exempt ones that invest only in short-term municipal securities, and then some that only do treasury bills. And if you are so inclined and you want to read about how these actually can lose money, type breaking the buck into any search engine and you will see the history and the discussion and what they're... Right now, the Securities Exchange Commission and the mutual fund industry are having a bit of a tug of war about what to do with these things, because right now money market mutual funds are not making any money whatsoever. And what are they paying you? 0.01%. And that's only because they're being nice to you. Some of them are paying you zero because they're not playing the game. The companies that are paying you 0.01% are actually taking money out of their pocket. They're asking the regulators if they can do it, and they have to get permission, and putting it into the fund just so they can pay you something. Whereas these guys are saying, look, we ain't making any money, you ain't making any money. So the Securities Exchange Commission is saying, well, this can't go on forever. Someday sometime interest rates are going to go back up, but who knows when that's going to be. Supposedly sometime in the middle of this year, watch the stock market drop 20-30% overnight. And that's a good sign, by the way. If the interest rates start coming up, folks, the market will react. People will get freaked out and jump off of bridges and the like. But that's a very good sign. That means we're finally coming out of the Great Recession. Okay. Now, so we've gone from the most riskiest to the least riskiest. And what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that there is a spectrum, right? There's a continuum. And what I find when I see people who are not ready to make, you know, the emotional and the intellectual decision, and they're just thrust this list of mutual funds at their 401k meeting, is they don't really understand volatility. They don't understand what it's like to lose a lot of money. So they will put all of their money, and they'll look at the one that's done the best over the last 10 years or 5 years or whatever, 1 year, and they'll put it all in here. Right? Bingo. And they hope to win. And they might. They might just do well. But what normally happens? When the market falls 10, 20, 30%, they freak out because their thing lost 40%. And they move it all the way over into the money market fund, only to watch the market come back 30, 40, 50, 100%. And then they yell out, ooh, 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 is it too late to get in? And put it back in the aggressive growth or the growth fund and watch the market drop 30%. And they yell, ooh, is it too late to get out? And we laugh because it's funny, right? But it's not funny when it's real money. It's not funny when it's your money. And the other side of the coin is you'll get somebody 22 years old who's just starting out, got a lot of debt from her student loan or whatever. She's got a good job. And she puts everything into the money market because that's what they told her. She couldn't lose money. You can lose money in bonds, yes. Don't normally, but it happens. You can lose money in stocks, yes. So she puts it all in the money market account, earning now 0.01%, maybe 2% someday. Does that make any sense? No, that's not a very good choice either. So you've got to get people, at least in my humble opinion, try to get them to just go in the middle here. You know, come on, relax. Get somewhere in the middle. If you're really worried, a balanced fund is a great choice. My humble opinion, bonds are far too conservative for young people. I don't think you should have any bonds, but that's me. Other people might say, oh, you need to. We'll talk about the formulas when we get to balancing and asset allocation. They think, you know, whatever your age is, if you're 20 years old, you should have 20% in bonds. 40% in bonds if you're 40. It's ridiculous. And because of this, because people make the most boneheaded decisions, very smart individuals, some of them on campus here, professors who can do things that I can't do. I can integrate and differentiate. I took my calculus, but other than that, I lost after that. I made it through differential equations. I got a gentleman's B. But some of the other mathematicians and some of the other scientists and the whatever, they can do things that are a whole lot smarter than I can do. But boy, do they make stupid mistakes when it comes to managing their money. And for that reason, the industry has created a whole new genre of mutual funds. These are mutual funds of mutual funds. You know it had to happen, right? And so what they do on your behalf is they say, look, when do you need the money? Do you need the money for college in 6 or 5 years, 2020? Do you need the retirement in 20 years or 50 years or whatever? You choose the lifestyle fund, the target date fund, the target risk fund. They go by the various names. And you're going to look up the thrift savings plan. They call them lifestyle funds. And then we will populate your mutual fund with mutual funds. If you're not going to retire until 2055, 40 years from now, we would have mostly stocks. And as you get closer to the time of your retirement, we will start moving you down the risk versus return spectrum. Make sense? Yeah? And so, yeah, I'm teasing them, right? You're kidding me, right? No, no, no. These are very popular now because of 401ks and 403bs. Because the employers are told, don't make any recommendations. Because first of all, they're not allowed, unless they're a registered representative. You're not allowed to make recommendations on what somebody else should buy for their financial goals. It's like, it's not as bad, but it's like giving somebody, you need this antibiotic. Here, take this. Or you should buy a trust, put up a trust for your family. It's like practicing without a doctor, practicing a lawyer. And if they do make a recommendation and it doesn't turn out well, they can get sued. So the employers don't want to give education. They don't want to give recommendation. And I think this is sad. I think it really is something that we're lacking. The Congress and the employment community should come up with something. There's actually an opportunity out there somewhere for a business to say, look, we want to educate people. And there's lots of people who try to do it, but mostly they're trying to sell you stuff. But so the Congress said, okay, if you create these lifestyle funds, if you create these target date funds, then you can automatically put those people, depending, you have their birthday, right? You know when they're going to retire. You can put them into that retirement account automatically, and you can't get sued for making a bad investment choice. You understand? That's why these things have become very popular. In your 401k, in your 403b, in the thrift savings plan, you will see these target date, target retirement lifestyle funds. Okay, now specialty funds. This is something that we should just put a big X through. Except for the REITs. Maybe you like real estate, I don't know. But hedge funds are not mutual funds, folks. They are very dangerous. They might make you rich. Some of them are high-flying. But they charge outrageous fees. And there's no regulatory oversight. There's they could put all their money into one stock if they wanted to. Remember 20 stocks? You have to have at least 20 stocks or 20 bonds in a mutual fund? These don't. They just basically, they can run roughshod. It used to be that you had to be a sophisticated investor, which meant you had $1 million of net assets, $200,000 of income, or a few other things. I forget what they are. But now, with as little as $5,000 or $10,000, which is still a good chunk of change, but not that much, you can get into a hedge fund. Stay away. All right? In my humble opinion. Bear funds try to make money when the market goes down. That's hard to do because the market goes down about once for every three times it goes up. So, precious metals, hard assets. We'll discuss gold at the very end of the semester. You want to buy gold? Go buy gold. Now, REIT funds, real estate investment trusts, are a great way to invest in real estate without being a landlord. The problem is there's just not that many of them. So, you can't really diversify because there's not that many REITs out there. And then all these boutique funds, these exotic funds. What does the stock car stocks funds invest in? Not quite close.
Advertisements.
They invest in the companies that advertise and sponsor NASCAR. Because I don't know about you, but I have a hard time believing that the biggest spectator sport in the United States is not football, not baseball or basketball, is NASCAR. People on a Sunday afternoon, 200,000 of them go out to the track and watch cars go around 200 miles an hour. And they drink beer. And they get their ears drum destroyed. And they buy Folgers coffee. If Folgers coffee is the official coffee of NASCAR, Nextel used to be the official, I don't know what it is now, but Nextel used to be the official cell phone of NASCAR, and they buy the company. How about the Paws Tombstone Fund? Paws is the name of the company. Tombstone was the name of the fund. What do they invest in? Think about it. Not pizza. Tombstones? What? Cemeteries. Mortuaries. Casket makers. Well, everybody's going to die someday. And thankfully, go to the Paws Tombstone Fund. And then you cannot make this up, dear students. There used to be a fund called the Chicken Little Growth Fund for people who were worried that the
sky was falling.
You can't make this stuff up. There, I don't know if it's still around. There was the Timothy Fund. There was something in the letter from Paul to Timothy about making good efforts with your businesses or something like that. So that was for good Christians who wanted to invest. Go ahead, type it in. Don't believe me. The choices are endless, and so are the fees, dear students. So are the fees. Now, we've already discussed index funds. And what you're going to find is that index funds have become the way, the only way, the perfect investment. When anybody says that, that scares me. These are mutual funds that buy and hold portfolios of stocks or bonds equivalent to those specific indices. The most popular one is the Standard & Poor's 500. Because they find, or they believe, that active management cannot beat the index over time. Well, that's not true. There are companies that have done it well over the long term. But there are others that haven't. There are a lot that haven't. It's true. They can offer much lower annual fees. They better. If they don't, that's because they're sneaking it into your 401k and basically raping you. And as they say, they'll tell, no, an actively managed fund beats the index. That's not true. Many don't. Many do. And we'll take a look at some that do. Because of the annual fee, an index fund cannot actually match the market's performance, but it should come very close, providing the annual fee is not excessive, which might be the case if they're trying to screw your employer and you employees. Whereas, as we saw in the previous chapter, an actively managed fund could substantially outperform or substantially underperform the index in the case of the Legg Mason Value Trust, which really stunk up the place over the last 10 years. The rationale for index funds came from research done in the early 1970s that statistically showed that many of the index actively managed funds did not beat the market. What they did is they just took a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. In other words, they just randomly picked stocks. And sometimes the random stocks beat the market and sometimes the actively managers did. What you want to do is look at a fund family where most all of their funds have consistently beaten their indexes over a decade, and there's only a few companies that can do this. In the late 1990s, index funds became victims of their own success, in my humble opinion. And here are the major indices, and we will come back to these indices in detail in Chapter 5. You will note that the Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow Jones 4500, it's not up here, but that's one of the ones in the Thrift Savings Plan. The EFA, what else? And then there's a couple bond funds. Those you will see when you're looking up the Thrift Savings Plan for your assignment. Index funds are the current perfect investment. For the fail-safe superlative treatment, visit IFA, Index Funds Advisors, who are going to, of course, help you buy the index funds for a fee. What are the downsides? Well, here is a slide that you will not understand, and we will come back to it after we've gone through stocks and bonds at the very, not the very end, but about three quarters into the semester. Sometimes indexes become skewed. You know what the word skewed means? Bent out of shape. They get bent out of shape towards a particular sector of the economy or the region of the world. And we'll discuss this in detail. And what the hell is PE? Relax. But in the late 1980s, the Japanese stock market had exploded. In fact, there was a song, I'm Turning Japanese. Now, most of you weren't even born yet. But it was the Japanese were going to take over the world. And the Japanese real estate market had Tokyo was worth more. The real estate in Tokyo was worth more than all in California. It was just insane. And you went out and bought the EFA, Europe, Australia, and the Far East, thinking that you were buying a broadly based international index fund when you were buying almost 60% Japanese stocks and 40% old Europe, Hong Kong, Australia, Canada, Singapore, everybody else. And the PEs, 52, which is pretty high, as we'll see, 13, which is very reasonable. The Japanese stock market then went on to lose 80% of its value, from 36,000 down to about 8,000. Right? Maybe, I think that's about 80%. And you thought you were buying a broadly based index. The Standard & Poor's 500 in the years 1990 to 1999 went in two directions, up and way up, and had produced a return of almost 20%. And so you bought the S&P 500 and thought you were getting a broadly based index. But what had happened is in the late 90s, a few companies, about 40, 50 companies, and some of them, well, AOL is still around, but CMGI and who else? Nortel. These companies that are gone, the internet bubble. Fully one-third of the 500 companies in the United States, market capitalization was information technology, internet, computers, software, and the like, with a PE of 60, which is, again, very high. Everybody else, what was being called in the late 1990s, the old economy, some of you might remember that term, the old economy, the food companies, the railroad companies, the energy companies, the healthcare sector, everything else in the United States was two-thirds with a PE of fairly high, but not very high, of 19. The NASDAQ, which represented the information technology sector, then went on to fall over 80%. Whereas the S&P as a whole lost about 50% between March of 2000 and October 2002. So the takeaway, dear students, is that there is no such thing as a perfect investment. Every investment has advantages. Every investment has disadvantages, index funds included. But you're going to hear differently. You're going to hear it because the drumbeat has gotten very loud that the only thing you should buy is an index fund. And when everybody's going in one direction, folks, that's usually a bad sign. Doesn't mean it's going to end badly, but it's usually a bad sign. Now, the popularity of index funds has spawned the world of ETFs, exchange-traded funds. They are open-ended mutual funds, but they trade on the stock exchange, as we discussed in the very first presentation, a week ago? There's no limit to the number of shares. They are becoming very popular because people are now using them as trading vehicles because you can trade them throughout the day. All the mutual funds we've discussed, all the open-end mutual funds, you only buy them once a day. That's it. There's only one price, NAV. But ETFs can be played like a stock all throughout the day, and many people do that. And now ETFs started as only index funds. There are now actively managed ETFs. So ETFs are starting to become the perfect investment. But the cool thing about ETFs, they have great names like Spider. Isn't that a great name? That's the S&P 500, because SPY is the symbol for S&P 500. And Diamond for the DIA, Dow Jones Industrial Average. And the Cube for the NASDAQ, because the NASDAQ has QQQ, so cubes. You don't like that? I think it's cool. Now, dear students, socially responsible funds. You're going to hear people talk about these. This was started back in the 1970s. Actually started a little bit earlier, but it wasn't called that then. Mutual funds that actively and directly incorporated ethics and morality into the investment decisions. It started out with some funds that refused to invest in alcohol or tobacco. Now, some of these funds go way back into the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s because they just knew there's a large percentage of the United States population that does not approve of alcohol, does not approve of cigarettes. But then it moved on to companies that pollute, that build weapons, nuclear power plants, destroy the rainforests, and then the companies that exploit labor. It's surprising there are any companies left to invest in. That's a joke. Silliness aside, many socially responsible funds have done quite well for their investors. Partly it's because many of these companies are in the tech world, and so that's what's done well ever since the 1970s, 80s, 90s. And possibly as a backlash to socially responsible funds and their perceived political overtones, there is a mutual fund called the Vice Fund. Yep, you guessed it, folks. What do they invest in? all the corporate nasties you can think of, right? He loves Philip Morris, loves Anheuser-Busch, gambling defense firms. And although it's still a pretty small fund, check it out. It's actually done pretty well. So thevicefund.com. And this is from your book, which is from Wall Street, based on classifications by Lipper. So the categories that we have up on your board are just the major categories. They go into sub-subcategories and sub-sub-subcategories. And do you have to know all these? No. Don't even try. Don't even try. Lastly, with regard to our types of mutual funds, is the Morningstar style box. They came out with this, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. And it encouraged mutual funds to go out and make even more categories because they broke things up into 9 boxes. Large, medium, small, value, blend, growth. So there's the, you know, the income-oriented, growth-oriented, a blend of those. And so people thought that they needed one mutual fund for every box. And so the mutual fund company said, okay, we'll create a mutual fund for every box. That's not what mutual funds are about for. They're for diversification. And so Morningstar has basically agreed that this wasn't the best idea. So now they have ownership zones. You see, they're not just in the box. Now it's an oval. See? So they say they're better. So check it out, Morningstar.com. Fund families. Are you still with us? Are you getting an education?
Yeah.
Good, 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 good. Fund families. Now, I don't know if we should spend too much time on this, but Forbes, many years ago, they had a great saying, choose a family, not a fund. And I like that. You find people with 17 or 23 funds, and you think, and they're all from different companies. They're like, why did you do that? Well, I heard this one. This one's kind of good. This one's not good. Choose a family, then decide, I'm assuming they have the prerequisite of the spectrum. Funds in the family vary in their objectives, and you can move your money from one fund to another within a fund family, almost always with no charge. But if the fund is in a taxable account, the IRS is going to say, hey, you know, you made a decision, you sold one, bought another, you have to pay capital gains or losses or whatever. Some funds will charge you excessive transfers. You can't transfer every month or every week or whatever. Some will just not let you do it. They'll give you, okay, get 10 transfers or 12 transfers a year. That's more than enough, folks. You can set up an automatic transfer if you want. But they don't. They're long-term investments. They don't want you buying and selling mutual funds like stocks. If you want to do that, that's what ETFs are for, but don't do it. It's not in your best interest, in my humble opinion. You decide. And so here are the 10 largest mutual fund companies as of February 2012. And the problem is that getting data for this is not easy to do, folks. This is from the ICI through somebody else. So the ICI, I try to get there. I think they're a little vague. They don't want to piss people off because they're the trade group for the mutual fund company, and depending on how you categorize some of the funds, some of them are a lot bigger. For example, BlackRock, which is a very smart company, they have under management far more than any of the others, but most of this is not mutual funds. But this is the company that has the TSP contract with the government. I don't know who landed it. I don't know whose brother-in-law. I don't know how they did it. But that was because, boy, wouldn't you just love to have 3 million customers ready at the handy? Just, there you go. But they are the big three. For many years, Fidelity was number one. And American was usually 2 or 3. But Vanguard is now number one, undisputed when it comes to mutual funds only. And they are getting the lion's share of new money coming in the industry because of their emphasis on index funds. By the way, Vanguard still has actively managed funds. American's been around. Vanguard's based in outside Philadelphia. They started in the 70s. And they're a nonprofit mutual fund, by the way. It's unusual. American's been around since the 30s. So has Fidelity. American's based in L.A., but they're all over the world. Fidelity's Boston. PIMCO. Have you heard of PIMCO? Pacific Investment Company based in Newport Beach. They've been in the news quite a bit. Franklin Templeton, a very good company based in L.A., but Templeton, we'll come back to him. T. Rowe Price in very good company based in Boston. No, not Baltimore. Baltimore. The guy, T. Rowe Price, was a genius, and he has kept that. Well, he's gone now. I feel sorry for people who have Columbia funds. I have some friends who have this, and they show me the prospectus and the annual report, and they're always saying, you know, we're going to do better next year. We're sure of it. We're going to do better next year. And I just kind of nod my head, yes. J.P. Morgan and Oppenheimer, Dallas, not bad. So now what I normally do will be to show you a list of just some of the Fidelity funds because they no longer publish a single list anymore. Now when you go on their website, they will show you 400 of them or 700 of them. It used to be Fidelity. You could go on their website and see all 10,000 that they would offer you. Now, wait a minute. Not all of those are mutual funds from Fidelity. Fidelity has about 500. But what Fidelity has done, they're very smart, is they've gone to all the other mutual fund companies, not all of them. Some of them say, no, thank you. And they allow their investors through Fidelity to buy mutual funds from other companies. Like you buy the Vice Fund or Columbia Fund through Fidelity. Very smart. So it's from Fidelity's point of view, and of course they take a little bit piece of the cut. But what I will show you is something from 2009, when it was one of the last things that they put it in a single list. And these are each and every one of them. Now, what I normally do is a little dramatic, because I try to read all of them. But you know what? I'm a little tired. So anybody want to try to read them as fast as they can? No? Blue chip value, equity income two, large cap value, 130/30 large cap, disciplined equity, dividend growth, fidelity, growth and income fund, mega cap stock, stock selector, stock manager stock, trend, trail discovery, blue chip growth, capital appreciation, contra fund, very good fund, by the way. Export and multinational Fidelity, 50 focus growth company, growth discovery, independence, large cap stock, Magellan, OTC portfolio, mid cap value, leverage company stock, low price stock, value strategies, mid cap growth. There's 9 more pages. Each and every one of these is a mutual fund. Which one do you want? Dang, I know. See, this is what you're up against when people have to decide what to invest in. Mid-cap stock, new millennium fund, lost small-cap discovery, small-cap stock, small-cap value, small-cap growth, small-cap independence. And then here are their index funds. Notice they use the term Spartan. Cheap, right? Abstemious, very cheap. Broadly diversified foreign stock funds, diversified international global commodities, international discovery, international growth, I missed one, international small cap, international value, overseas, total international equity. What's the difference between overseas and international? I don't know. Worldwide, and then there's Canada, Nordic. You can buy a mutual fund and invest in Nordic companies. Emerging markets, Latin America, emerging Europe, Middle East, Africa, Southeast Asia, index funds for foreign specialty funds. Here are all the sector funds, folks. Unless you know you're in the energy sector and you know that energy is about ready to fall or do well, go ahead, buy a little bit of these sector funds. But we buy a mutual fund for diversification, not for concentration, but that's up to you. And look at all the different sectors funds. There are 80 different sector funds. And now finally we have our bond funds, state-specific, national mutual funds. They have two different California funds, New Jersey, New York, Michigan, Massachusetts. There are the high-yield junk bond funds. And then here is a good example between a balanced fund and a dynamic strategies. Remember we talked about a true balanced fund? That just keeps, you know, 50-50 stocks and bonds, maybe 60-40. Dynamic strategies implies that they're doing more asset allocation. Now, does it mean that that's what's going on? You have to do your research. Make sense? Okay, good. Now, here come the target date funds. If you want to invest so that you retire by 2050, there you go. And what they will do is they will populate this mutual fund with mostly stock funds to begin with. And as you get closer to 2050, they will move down the risk versus reward. They've got dozens of money market funds. I don't know why, but look at that. State-specific, national munis, taxable. Why do you need 12 money market funds? I don't know. And then finally, here are the 529 plans. These are the college savings plans. They do the college savings plan for California. They do it for Delaware. They do it for Arizona. They do it for New Hampshire. They better do it for Massachusetts because they're based in Boston. And there's over 489 or so mutual funds. Now do you understand what I was trying to get at? Where do you start? If you call Fidelity and say, well, which one? They go, oh, we don't know. What do you think? Oh, yeah, try this one. Vanguard is not as bad. Let's get Vanguard on the scene. Where's Vanguard? There's Vanguard. And this is from 2007, by the way. I should really update this. I should just make my own. But they go the other way. They start with the most riskiest down here, and they start with the least riskiest. So they're money market, state-specific money markets, bond funds. Notice they put the short-term first, because short-term bond funds are less risky than intermediate-term, which are less risky than long-term. And then there's the tax-exempt bond funds. Notice they have an asset allocation fund and a balanced index fund. All other things being equal, and we don't know that they are, I would go with the balanced index fund and the asset allocation fund because I'm not a fan of people trying to time the market, deciding when the good time to buy stocks, when it's not. Wellington, Wesley, well-managed, actively managed funds. Even though Vanguard touts index funds, they have some actively managed funds. And they have a company called PrimeCap. These are people who used to work for American. They went off on their own and started PrimeCap. And they have been geniuses. So they're not getting rid of PrimeCap. Here are their target retirement funds, 2040, 2050 for you younger folks. Their value funds, capital, more aggressive capital opportunity. That's like capital appreciation. PrimeCap, that's if you can get into PrimeCap and Vanguard, that's a good fund. They have a few sector funds, energy, healthcare, gold, mining and minerals, and real estate investments, and then your international and global. Cool? What do you think? Now, the last fund I want you to take a look at is American. And what I like about American is it fits on one page, and you can see it. But what they did, and they've changed the colors, and I sent them a letter saying, you know, I think you guys screwed up, because I thought they changed it from to blue. No, you don't want blue. You want red. Because this is the most risky. These are the growth funds. They don't have any aggressive growth funds. Growth and income, equity income, balanced, and then the bond funds. And we cut off. They only have one money market fund, so I cut that off. But what you see here, folks, if you look at the lifetime returns, you see the returns starting off fairly good, you know, 10, 11, 12, 1, 13%. And then as we get down to the bond funds, we see the returns going down. Make sense? That's what you expect. And that's indeed what happens. Now, sometimes this guy's only been around for a couple of years. This guy's been around less than, you know, since 87. But notice, 73. Look at the guy, 73, 13%. 1950, 11.5%. This is good results. These are good results. But then in the bond funds, where's their high income trust? 8.6, that's the junk bond fund. So 8.6 out of a bond fund, that's pretty darn good. A regular bond fund of America, that's their corporate bond fund, 8.3. But short-term bond fund, 2.3. And that hasn't been around that long. So that was 2013. They haven't come out with the 2014 yet. But I want to show you 2008, okay, because you need to see it. Everybody's got to see it. You got, you know, awareness, knowledge is power, and we got to, this is the thing about human nature. Your brain eventually gets rid of unpleasant thoughts or hides them, and so I bring it up every semester so I can look at it and cry. 2008. I have a lot of that one, but I don't recommend this one to people. But look, it's exactly what we expect. Here's the equity income funds, right? And they don't even have aggressive growth funds that lost 60-70%. But look at the growth funds, lost 40, 49, 52. The growth in income, 34, 41, 42, 38, 36. The equity income, 34, 33. The balance fund lost 30. Look at the junk bond fund lost 30, but then look at what the bond funds lost, a whole lot less. The volatility is real. Does it make sense? And then the one that went up, the U.S. Treasury bonds. Because when the organic matter hits the ventilating device, people flock. It's called a flight to quality. People flock to Treasury bonds because they know the government ain't going anywhere soon. And then the municipal bonds, I just cut those off. Well, we could put them up there. The municipal bonds, they got clobbered too. Look at the high income, the junk bond fund for the municipal got clobbered. Oops, that didn't work. Oh, forget that. But the California lost 15%. Yeah. So 2008 was an ugly, ugly year. We don't want to go through that anytime soon, okay? I don't want to go through that anytime soon. But we will. We will. Okay, questions, thoughts, ideas? Do you know which one to pick yet? No? What? You don't? Would you trust an advisor to recommend to you a mutual fund? No. So you're screwed. You don't know which one to pick. You don't trust an advisor. What are you going to do? I'm going to put my money in the money market. I'll give it to the banker. He'll give me a toaster and a waffle iron. Okay. Now, let's take a few, actually. Go ahead. Yeah.
Can you say that if you go to the bank, they work from a different company?
If you go to the bank or the credit union, say, I want a mutual fund, or I want to get more than 1% on my money, or 0.1% of my money, what they will do is they will move you over to another part of the bank, and there'll be somebody sitting there with a nice tie and suit on. Maybe not. He might not be there. She might not be there. So, we'll be there tomorrow at 2 o'clock. I'll make an appointment. Have you noticed those guys or gals in the credit unions? They move around. They don't stay in one. Maybe if it's a big branch, they might stay in one. And now you're no longer dealing with the one company. You understand? You're not dealing with Wells Fargo. You're now dealing with Wells Fargo Advisors. You're not dealing with Mission Federal Credit Union. You're dealing with Credit Union Securities Organization. I forget the CUSO. It's called CUSO. I forget what it stands for. Anybody work for those? I had Philip there for a while. He could help me. So, now, well, let's take a break for a minute because I don't want to go through these right now because we'll come back to these guys. But I want to pass out the assignment sheet. This is probably a good time. Now that you're thoroughly overwhelmed and maybe ready to give up and drop the class, let's take a look at the assignment for Chapter 4. Because what I want you to do is investigate one or two mutual fund companies. On the website, I have links to six different companies, all of which I think are pretty good. I'm not really that big a fan of Fidelity, folks. But I like Vanguard, what they do. I love American. I love Dodge & Cox, T. Rowe Price, Franklin. They're all very good companies. But there are others. I should put Oppenheimer on there. They're a pretty good company. MFS has been around forever. BlackRock, Columbia. But Federated. But there are lots of good companies. And so what I'm going to have you do is either download. I have some here, and everybody can get one, but please do bring them back because they give them to me for free. But, you know, they're not free. It costs them money. And so I'll give everybody one, and as we leave, whichever one you want, I'll give you. Growth, global, domestic. I have growth and income, global, domestic. I have equity income. I have some bond funds. I don't think I have money market. Maybe I have one or two money markets. So, along with the prospectus, one of the most important documents for potential mutual fund investors is the mutual fund annual report. Some are very sparse. Others are rich in information. Some are easy to read. Many are difficult to penetrate. The more difficult they are to penetrate, that usually means the worse they did. And they're trying to hide it from you. Each student will examine one or two mutual fund annual reports. And as I said, there are links to six different companies, There are dozens and dozens of companies, folks, and thousands of mutual funds. And I have, this is for mostly for the online students. Come on by. Read the annual report carefully. Now, the first several pages are relatively easy to read. Then you, this is not an annual report. That is. The first several pages are fairly easy to read, but then it starts to get a little more difficult when it gets into different types of companies they invest in. But do look for the different companies they invest in. And then it starts to get to the accounting information at the end, and it gets kind of, forget that. So forget all that stuff with the financial statements and everything. Unless you're an accounting major and want to test your ability to figure out what the hell they're telling you. And there's a saying in the industry that the cheaper the paper, the more important the information. And it's, for the most part, kind of true, but it's also harder to read. This is the prospectus, and I used to hand those out, but people didn't read them, so I'm not going to hand that out. But I will hand these out. So then you're going to do is try to find as much information in here as you can using the annual report, the company's website, Lipper or Morningstar. Now, Lipper, you have to pay for. So if you go to the library, you've heard of libraries, right? You've heard of them? Cool places, folks, libraries. Lipper, it's free. So you go to the library and get it for free. Morningstar is free at the library. Morningstar, the website, will give you certain information, but as you go along, it'll keep throwing things up saying, wouldn't you like to sign up for premium access? Only $50. And then, and then a couple weeks later, it'll say, only $20. You know, get dropped the price, try to get you to sign up. So don't sign up. At Yahoo's website, and we'll take a look at these as time goes by, to get as much information as you can. And so have fun. That's the idea. Now, the other side is the thrift savings plan. Anybody in the military? Military folks? No? We had one. James, he's not here right now. But the thrift savings plan is the 401k for federal employees. And it's actually, I mean, my humble opinion, it's pretty well run. Considering the size of the federal government, this is a very well-run 401k. The fees are extremely low. But as I was telling James last Wednesday, what they miss, I think, is the education. And I know why, because they're afraid they don't want to get sued. But I told you, I get the guys at the border. They're asking me, should I stay with the CC fund? Yeah, you're young. Stay with the CC fund. Get some I and some S and, you know, make sure you have some balance. And if you're really worried, go ahead, have some F and G, but you don't need it. You're too young. That's my humble opinion. So check out the Thrift Savings Plan. What do you think the website is? Thrift Savings Plan. You can try that and you'll wind up with the, you know, Google or Yahoo yelling out, I think you want TSP.gov. TSP.gov. So that you, if you type Thrift Savings Plan, it'll come up and say, ooh, did you mean ThriftSavingsPlan.gov? So TS, so the first answer, I'll give you the first answer. How's that? What is the name of the website? TSP.gov, right? If you put TSP.com, somebody will try to sell you something. All right, questions, thoughts, ideas?
Find all the information, or do you need one of these two?
For TSP.gov?
No, for the...
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking me. Find all the information for this?
Yeah.
You should be able to. One of the problems is understanding what you're trying to find. That's always a problem. What I find is people have the hardest thing trying to figure out what the benchmark is. Benchmark is another word for index, which is another word for list. And these are the list of stocks or bonds that the mutual fund is comparing themselves to. Now, sometimes this is easy. If it's a domestic, large cap, growth and income fund, that's the Standard & Poor's 500. But once you move from these very generic categories, 50 years ago, we didn't say domestic large cap growth and income funds. Almost all stock funds were domestic large cap growth and income funds. I mean, that's what the names came afterwards. So now, if you have an aggressive growth, you know, domestic large cap fund, That's some of that's the S&P 500, but not all of it. So sometimes comparing the index fund against a certain benchmark is not very good. And they'll talk about it often in the annual report. They'll say, well, we don't really fit this index or that index, so we show you these four indices, and we've done better than these two, and we don't do as well as this one, but that's because we do this. They're not perfect. Okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit myself over here, and as you guys leave, tell me what ones you're interested in. I'll tell you what I got. I wish I was better organized, but I'm not, so I apologize. But I've got global growth. I've got developing markets. I've got global growth and income. I've got equity income. Growth and I got a lot of growth and income. Balanced. I've got balanced, global balance, and I've got bond funds and growth funds. So, you want growth? One of my favorites, Growth Fund of America.
Can I get a global?
Global. What do you want, global emerging markets?
Yeah.
Here you go, global emerging markets. Balance. Okay, hang on. Where's the bearing? Balance right here. Let me turn this off. You don't want to listen to this, do you? Okay.